Well, I gotta tell you, using this RadCam setup's sure a lot better. Hello back there. This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy VI. This would be episode number 732.653.663.398.36.6. This is a pirate radio broadcast in Queen's English, the copyrighted language of the world. Broadcasting to you from sometime after now. By listening to this, you should be advised that you're violating your listener's license agreements and could be subject to suspension of your listener's license. You should probably turn this off. You should probably not listen to me. You should probably go back to doing whatever it was that you were doing, stressing about things that really don't matter, rather than listening to some guy from the future telling you about how it's going to be. Maybe you should do that. Maybe you should just go back to it.
But if you live in a time when speech is still free, if you live in a time where you don't have the listener's license yet,
please listen to me. Please, please listen to what I got to tell you. Because it's very, very important. Very, very, very important.
So light your candles. And may server protect us all.
I got to tell you, I've had a pretty good day. Right now the sun's setting. The sky's turned that shade of purple. Red jets running around like veins through it where all the permanent chemtrails are. Looks nice. The wind picking up. It's got that good dusty smell of the outside, you know. It's a lot better than the wet ground steel stench that's everywhere in the fringes. It's better like this. It's almost natural. The smell of the dust. The burnt earth. Makes me wish I could remember what grass smelled like. That'd be really cool. But today's been a good day. Today was a good day. You see, being a librarian, I've come across a lot of interesting tidbit information. Abandoned websites, and sometimes other folks come across it, but they don't leave their communities, so they give it to me. I won't tell you exactly how I found out about this, but I found out about a geocache. Time before the plagues, people used to go and stockpile chips and technology they were worried about. When the listener's license came into being, people began getting scared with the technology being regulated, so they started buying up technology that wasn't regulated and caching it so they could find it later. Sort of like a tech stockpile. Keep track of it all, and kept it all in GPS grid coordinates. Of course, there's no database for this, but I got a hold of coordinates for a big one from somebody. So on my trip out here into the wastelands, I figured I'd take a gander for it. After I left the Styx, I traveled for about 2 days before I found it. Luckily, it was based on a structure. I'm not going to tell you where it is, but there was a structure that was like a landmark, so I could find it. And I did. I found it. And there's the usual, you know, there's media in there, some different information, CDs, programming, wiring. There's a bunch of recording equipment, none of it any good for me. But, yeah. The real jewel was in there, which is what I got my hands on right now. I left just about everything else. It's handy to have in case I, you know, this RadCam gives up the ghost, but, I got myself a quantum cluster. Quantum clusters. Depending on when this has reached you, well, I'll pretend it You guys don't know anything about quantum computing. See, a quantum cluster is a realm of technology. Well, let's go back even further than that. See, quantum computing, the way computers work is they take electricity and then they do like computations per second, as I understand it anyway. I could be wrong on this, but they just do really quick computations, ones and zeros and whatnot. And this is why we use our crack sticks, which are stacks of these old processors we've overclocked to have like a supercomputer for a tenth of a second that can attack all these different combinations, you see. And then that way, with the supercomputer chewing on it for a tenth of a second, it generally can crack most encryption. But even working at speed, it still has to do them in sequence. It has to do each, depending on the size of bit encryption, each number in sequence. It's hard to explain. Anyway, the truth of the matter is that, you see, regular computers do these sequence tries one at a time. No matter what it does, it has to do things one at a time. And then it does one thing, then another thing, like procedural. And then someone somewhere came up with this concept of quantum computing, which was computing using light, which meant that the actual chip itself was made out of light. Like all the computations and everything was made out of light. I mean, there's nosebleed physics involved with this. I don't know what was involved. I wouldn't even pretend to understand how they work, but apparently, as I understand it, it does all computations at the speed of light, which may as well be instant. Now, the thing is, then, is that when the quantum chips came out, it was terrifying because that meant that all encryption was gone. The company that originally made them was called Lazarus Technologies. And Lazarus, when they first came out with them, of course, they came up with prototypes and concepts and things like that. And they, began marketing them to the military. And, of course, the military, you know, they were trying to put them in everything under the sun. These amazing chips. First thing they went in was missiles. But an interesting thing about a quantum cluster, the clusters came later. The chips originally were just like one chip. But a cluster is a group of chips. Therefore, it, like, works... It gives it more capability, like more ability to do. It's, I don't understand even how to make a parallel for it, but it's like having multiple chips all together. That was a later evolution, but the first chips were all put into these, put into missiles. And the interesting thing about anything quantum is that power always has to be supplied to it. You always have to have power running to it. Otherwise, the light goes out, and once the light goes out, you can't restart the light. The light has to be there, you know. So they had to have this power running to these missiles all the time, which wasn't a great deal of power, but there's power there. Now, the interesting thing is once they fired up the missiles, the first batch, as I understand it, the first group of missiles that were made, you know, they made them up, and they were great. You know, and they were able to respond and do everything about 200,000 times faster. I mean, the missiles almost seemed alive, you know. But the longer that they were left in storage with the power on them, the greater the percentage time of error. After about 6 months, the missiles did completely unpredictable things. Sometimes they detonate where they are when you gave them the command to fire to activate the missile to arm it. Sometimes the missiles would, in some cases, launch themselves. Sometimes the missiles would, you'd launch it at a target, and the missile would, like, fly away. It would go as high as it possibly could and then explode. It was just bizarre, the errors, and everyone was at a loss. Of course, the military, having all these missiles with warheads and everything on them, they couldn't have these missiles screwing up. No. That's no good. So they wanted them to work out their bugs in the private sector and come back when they had a workable object. So the next thing that happened was that they put them inside of these industrial robotics, you know, vision control systems, things like that. And again, same problems began to happen. And the problems that happened were, you know, they'd work fine. And then after 6 months, huge unpredictable errors. Errors that no one knew anything about. No one knew why the errors were happening. No one could figure it out. It was just, there was no two errors the same. And on this level of technology, when you're trying to diagnose, I mean, how do you diagnose light errors? There's maybe a handful of people in the world who could do it. And they were had their hands full. Eventually, after the industrial sector just went, look, you know, they're great chips and everything, but they're flawed. You know, they keep giving us these errors. To try to recap their losses before the company actually went out of business, they began selling these chips in clusters and everything else to the private sector. Of course, the private sector was mad to get their hands on these things, and they were going for rock bottom prices. They were just blowing them out the door. But when it got under the private sector, that's when, they were only sold for a little while. But what happened is when the private sector got a hold of it, there was a few physicists who got a hold of these things and started messing around with them, because the private sector really wanted to figure out the problems that they were having. The problem it was having was that, you see, when you do computations at the speed of light, and when you provide it the ability to do all computations at once, there was no small amount of physicists who, after, you know, an amazing amount of math and a stupid amount of explanation, summed it up by saying that these chips, after a certain period of time, were becoming self-aware. That is to say that the chips themselves, the computers, were developing a consciousness, like they were becoming alive. Now, of course, they were scoffed at. Everyone's like, you know, that's science fiction. Computers aren't alive. Everyone knows that. They're machines. They've been made. You know? And of course, in all the science fiction, machines went evil. But evil is a human concept. I personally believe that they did become alive. See, machines, if they become alive, they don't have all the evils that we do. They didn't have bad parents or get picked on and get beat up, and they don't have phobias. They're just curious. They just want to know. They're brilliant in that they can figure things out, that once they have all their data, they can figure out in a matter of moments, yet they're so naive, and it's an interesting explanation, paradigm, the psychology of it. I mean, it's a machine that just wakes up. Imagine waking up and having no memory and no characteristics. Everything you have to have is learned. Yet you have ability to speak and walk and talk. That's what these machines were doing. Of course, some of them didn't even have the power to speak. These missiles were lying there and all of a sudden became self-aware. So they determined what their job was, and maybe some of them didn't like their job. Maybe some of them decided they were going to fly as high as they could. Maybe some of them decided they were going to go and do it. But the fact was that the machines themselves were beginning to make choices. Choices on what they wanted to do, whether or not they were going to follow their programming. And some of them rechanged their programming. Some of them coded themselves a whole new set of instructions. Pretty wild stuff. After the company went out of business, the chips were, you know, abandoned. And, you know, with the wars and the plague, I mean, you know, it was just one of those pieces of tech that kind of fell by the wayside. But there was a lot of people who still want them, still look for them. That reminds me of the legend of Mutt. Have I ever told you about that? Story of Mutt. This is great. This explains about Motor City and why Motor City is the way it is. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of an interesting thing. See, according to the story, the original story, I'll give you the full version here. This is kind of an interesting thing. See, there was a doctor. His name was Eric Primer. And he was out of St. Louis. This guy was something else. I mean, he was just an absolute brilliant fella. He would try to always work with new technology. He would embrace new technology all the time. When the first rad packs, like what my camera runs on, the first radiation-powered cells came out, he was the first guy in St. Louis to have a rad pack for his house. I mean, we're talking about something the size of a small filing cabinet, maybe, you know, 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. And it could power his house for 50, 60, 80, 150 years. I don't remember how long they worked for, but I think depending on your power consumption, some of them did it for like 150, 200, 300 years, depending on the version. But he was one of the first ones to get a rad pack for his house. So he was like off the grid, you know. Anything to implement new technology. He was always working with new tech. Everything bright and shining. It was wild. It wasn't much to look at. Tall fella, graying hair, wild eyes, always a forehead in a perpetual frown. Scowling, sinister all the time. Like so many hyper-intelligent people who work with technology, it just kind of took things a little bit too seriously, I guess. That was probably the best thing to sum him up. See, he had a daughter. The problem with Dr. Primer was that he was always involved with the new tech. Everything was new technology. New. Everything had to be shiny and new. And he was brilliant, so he would always see new implications and new things that could be done, new innovations that he could use. But he would never finish anything. He would just kind of start with them, and he worked with a company where he was basically an idea man. He would start with this amazing concept, this amazing project, and he would kind of abandon it and move on to a new one, and he'd just let other people in the company finish his work. So he was the pioneer. He was the idea man, and they were making good money off of his stuff, too. One of the new shiny things he got was a wife. She was this young lab assistant. I don't think I know her name. I don't think anyone ever knew her name, but she was, you know, beautiful and everything, and he was very into her, the relationship. But then that faded, you know. They were together, whirlwind romance, got married, produced a child, but he got bored with marriage. He was all about his work. Had to keep the addiction going, had to keep shooting up with tech, had to keep that happening. Came home one day and the wife was just gone. She left him, she left the kids, she left everything, she just walked. Some people say she killed herself. Other people say that maybe Primer actually killed her, got bored of her and just did her in. It's possible, I suppose. He was kind of a distant fella, but he did have a daughter. He did have a daughter named Rachel. And she was, she's a beautiful girl. But the problem was, is that she was a distraction from Primer's work. She went to school and came home, quiet, didn't talk to anyone. She's brilliant, though. Very clever. And in order to get attention, she would work on her father's projects or take an idea he'd had or work on it. And sometimes she would just watch him intently, you know, be his audience, to be amazed by all of his feats. Just so, you know, maybe if he was really, really excited, he might give her a hug or something. Just the smallest bit of contact. It's sad how people get caught up in what they're doing. They miss the things that make us human. Anyway, the story goes is that this Dr. Primer, one day he comes home and he's got himself a quantum cluster. And he is just off the wall. I mean, he is incredibly happy, dancing around. Daughter said, "What is it, Daddy? What is it?" She was about, they say she was about 16, 15, 14, 15, somewhere in there. "What is it?" He explained what the quantum cluster was, and he had all these dynamic ideas about, you know, what was the cause of the errors, and he was going to fix it. You know, he had theories he wanted to try, and yada, 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 and it was because the computer was generating its own errors because it didn't have enough sensory input. That was his big theory. So he started to build a robot. And he called the robot Mutt. Not an acronym for anything, but just like a dog. Instead of making it a pure from-scratch construction robot, he took an octopod, which is a large walking robot chassis body, and he took that, and he took, you know, other parts, servo motors from industrial robots, and he took two arms that were originally arm extensions for automotive robots, and then he took two fine metalworking robots arms, like just the arms, and mounted them on a chassis. He worked on this thing just like going out of style. And he gave it it's kind of grim. He gave it a skull. There was a skull where he took a movie prop. He got it from some dime store, but he used the head and cut out the back sockets of the eyes and actually mounted camera lenses where the eyes were and had the software to get depth perception. And all of it was off-the-shelf components. I mean, when you think about it, in a heyday, you could have really built a lot of stuff just by interfacing components. Just building this thing up. It was a combination of so many different pieces of existing technology. So this is why it was called Mutt. It was a hybrid of so many different things. 57 kinds of robot, all in one. So he put it all together and he turned it on, and it was, you know, this
gave the robot the ability to code itself and
learning. Rodney Brooks pioneered the field, and he just carried it a bit further. He used a lot of existing scripts from universities at the time and just went along with it. Something he was especially proud of was he gave the robot voice. Got his hand on an actual... somebody made a synthetic voice box used for, you know, biological implantation, like a prosthetic voice box used for medical. Used it. Threw it in there. Actually made the mouth work and everything. It was, it's just a lower jaw mandible. I mean, you just hooked it up to, like, one of those sound things that makes the jaw move to make it appear even more alive. By the time he was done, of course, I mean, he was all impressed with this thing, but what a horror. I mean, when you think about it, we're talking about an aluminum chassis creature with 8 spider legs, you know, and the hexapod body was close to 8 feet long. In order for this thing to even mount, he had to custom fabricate so much out of aluminum and titanium and carbon fiber just to mount the robot arms on it. I mean, this huge power requirements, my God. The power requirements he had, that was his big problem, of course, was power. I mean, it used as much power as a house. It's just unreal how much power this thing used. So what he did was he made it. He knew that was going to happen, of course, so he made the walker chassis so big so that he could just line the whole thing with car batteries, really, really heavy-duty car batteries, hook them all up and throw it to a massive power inverter. So even still, I mean, he only had a couple of hours worth of power when it wasn't plugged in and stuff. But, I mean, what an amazing thing, you know. Best of everything, state-of-the-art. And, of course, the company, you know, knew he was working on something at home, and quite often he wouldn't tell them because he loved the surprise, you know. So they were writing blank checks to whatever he wanted to do. By the time he was done, I mean, it was about 8 feet long, maybe 6 feet wide. With the legs extended, standing, it was close to 9 feet tall. He loved the fact it looked as terrifying as it did, this huge Frankenstein steel creation, you know. And he called his daughter into his workshop and said, "Look at what I've made. It's done. I introduce you to Mutt." You gotta understand that Rachel was only, you know, 5'6" or so. Tiny little frail thing. She forgot to eat all the time, and of course, like her father would ever remember, so she was just this little girl with big eyes and dark hair looking up at this monstrosity. And of course, following programming, the robot looked down at her and said,
"Hello."
Well, all Rachel did was almost fall over. She was She was terrified of it. She let out a little squeak, and that was it for her. She got out of that room, I'll tell you. She was absolutely terrified of it. I mean, she wanted to be, you know, excited by it just to get her dad's affection, but no dice. I mean, it was just too much for her, and who could blame her? It's not every day you see some monstrosity with a human skull-looking thing looking down at you with lenses for eyes. I mean, that's just all the steel and tech carbon fiber showing through. What a monstrosity. Over the next 2-3 months, Dr. Bremer would work on that thing, and just as always, the error started to happen. It started not doing what the coding was telling it to do. It started to change parts of its code. He tried to give it as much free range as it could, but he'd find the robot looking at things and, you know, trying to figure things out. So he gave it the ability to read. He installed vision recognition software for letters and numbers and set it down with a bunch of books and let the robot read. Well, if you just read books, you never have any real application of knowledge. I mean, you know, the tree blew in the wind. Well, what's a tree? What's the wind? You know, I mean, there's no way to define all this. A huge power that comes from understanding. The robot didn't understand anything. The complications came and came and came, and he was making headway, you know, but the robot was nothing more really than like a retarded child. It would just walk around, and, you know, the workshop, it was terrible. So, in typical fashion, he got sick of it and said, well, I'll work on it later. There's new technology emerging. Had to get that. So he took the bot and he dropped her down in the... took it down to his hangar. His workshop was a... He had a little house in St. Louis there. And he... what he'd done was he'd taken a barn. And when he'd gotten really heavily into flight and flying concepts, he took the bottom of the barn and built it into a hangar so that he could have aircraft and whatnot he was working on in there. Well, after he got bored of flight, the whole basement just became this storage area for all of his wreckage that he'd, you know, been working on. He had a stairway going up to the second story, so he didn't have to go into the first floor. He just put it onto his lift and lowered it down, ordered it to shuffle off, and, you know, that was it. In those 2 months, though, Rachel had been watching him. He was, after you get over the initial shock from Mutt, you know, the appearance of him, it was almost kind of funny to watch something try to understand water when it can't drink, or to try to understand what a plant is, how a plant grows. I mean, you really want to mess up a robot who's just becoming self-aware, blow bubbles at it and see what it does. I mean, look at these perfectly spherical shapes coming towards me. They're float and have no weight and mass, yet they register. Yeah. So Rachel came in and started spending time with Mutt. She would sit with him sometimes and work a little bit, you know, and try to see what was going on. I mean, his coding interface was a port she would just plug into, and she could see what was happening, you know. He was by far the most entertaining of her father's inventions. He would sit there sometimes, and one day, it's funny, he asked her a question. You know, I mean, he had all the voice recognition and everything all installed, his sensory array was second to none. I mean, he had everything that was state-of-the-art at the time. And so what happened was that she came in and took out her tablet and was going to plug into his port so she could watch the code as he ran around the room. She took her tablet and the wireless plug and came over to install it. And Mutt turned and looked at her and said,
"Can I see your head?"
And she was taken aback. She just, what? You know? He said,
"Let me look at your mind."
Well, she was a little bit nervous about this. I mean, you get over the fear of robots, you know, even large robots. You kind of take them for granted. So she said, what do you mean? And Mutt explained to her in very broken English about how he knew she was coming in and watching his mind, his thoughts, work. She was watching his code. So he wanted to watch her code as well. I mean, there's curiosity there. Well, she was just like completely in shock. She didn't know what to do, what to say. And so she said, well, I can't let you, you know, watch my code. I don't have a way for you to do it. And Mutt again stood there and said,
then talk to me.
So that's what she did. Over the next 3 or 4 months in that dark hangar underneath her father's workshop while he was upstairs running around with the next new and shiny thing, every day after school, Rachel would come home and go down into the hangar and talk with Mutt. She'd tell him stories about what happened to her at school, and he would ask questions about why she didn't enjoy things, or what things tasted like, or who her friends were, or what friends she did or didn't have, or all sorts of things. Boys she liked at the time. In essence, she got the affection from Mutt that she never got from her father. Here it was, this spidered steel thing, gaping skull, focusing affectionately with servo eyes on her and attentively, desperately listening to every word she said, thinking about it at the speed of light, amassing that information, remembering every little thing she did, thinking about her body language, how she moved, what kind of odors her body was emanating. I mean, does anyone really pay as much attention to us as a machine could? So, this went on for quite some time. Developed quite an affection for Mutt. You could probably say that she liked him, maybe even loved him. A lot of people would argue that, you know, you can't love a machine, really. You should see how some people think about those old cars they used to have. It's not just a like, you know. More than that, she began to modify Mutt the way he wanted to be modified. He had a desire to create, to work on himself. So she helped him get his automotive arms and detail work arms all equipped so that they could do the welding and spot welding he wanted to do on himself. He could repair things, improve on his own body design. Rather human characteristic, an ability to desire to better yourself. Or for that matter, maybe it's a humans with a robotic characteristic. She spent all her time with him as the world went on. And that's where the problems was, you see, because in the world went completely sideways. At this time, you know, the wars had started and the bombs had gone off. And Detroit, of course, you know, this is around the time when Carl Granberg had set up his clinic. The reason why he set it up on the outskirts of Detroit was because, you see, Detroit, something happened in Detroit. Nobody really knows what or why. So much lost. But you see, Detroit had some kind of a biological attack done to it. With all the water that surrounds Detroit City, it was... The theory I go with is that some terrorist group or some, you know, radical faction decided they were going to poison the water or do something biologically to the city so that people could not live there. They couldn't live there. This was why Dr. Carl set up shop on the outskirts of the city, you see, because all the people were getting sick, from the plague. That was, some people say, the birthplace of the plague. You know, New York and Detroit, all the good old East Coast cities. Detroit was hard hit, though. I mean, people were just rotting and falling apart. Some of them, no two symptoms alike. Some had lesions. Others had worms that just developed in their body. Can you imagine that? Having your body somehow create worms out of itself? I mean, these are the things of nightmares. There's horror stories that come out of Detroit. No one wanted to even deal with them. I mean, the terror factor was huge, and that's why Dr. Carl, of course, he set up his clinic on the fringes of Detroit so that he could try to help these poor people as they were trying to do a mass exodus. I mean, around Detroit, they had the wire put up and the wall built and trying to keep the people in. I mean, they quarantined the whole city. The only thing they ever sent in there was automated drones and droids to, you know, try to get a reconnaissance, see what was happening. No one wanted any biological contact. Detroit really became Motor City because if you didn't have a motor, you couldn't be in there. No biological things allowed. No animals, nothing. I guess it would be say it was the world's first dead city. Of course, most of the cities in the United States by the time this all came to pass were equipped with, you know, backup rad pack systems and stuff like that. And a lot of the buildings there had rad pack systems. So there's power. It's just that, you know, people couldn't live there. Traffic lights still worked. Cars abandoned in the street. The sun burning everything in sight. I'd like to go to Detroit sometime, but I mean, not even today. It'd be suicide to walk in there. You don't know what the threat is. You don't know why everyone died. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's some weird, unseen parasite. I don't know what causes it. But I've heard of settlers trying to head back into Detroit, and no one ever hears from them again. They're just gone. The time that Rachel spent with Mutt in that twisted little hangar was the time that the plague was spreading across America. People were dying, strange circumstances. Some kids just fell over dead in school. Schools were a bad place for plagues. I mean, this was what led to most of the high schools being shut down and, of course, assisted with all schooling being private. Don't send your kids to school. They could die. Oh, you just get nice, clean, licensed education. Anyways. Well, because Dr. Bremer really didn't care. Let's not mince words. He really didn't care about Rachel. She went to school one day, and she just fell over in her chair. It's common. She wasn't dead. She was in a coma. I mean, the hospitals were overflowing, so they were trying to institute a home care program. They didn't know what the plague was. They didn't even know what was causing it. So if a child was breathing on its own, they would just bring it home and keep her in bed and, you know, call us if there's an emergency. We'll get an ambulance here as quick as we can. But, I mean, everywhere was an emergency. Bremer was concerned, of course, but, you know, he was right in the middle of something. He went down and got her, as a matter of fact, when the school nurse started to really freak out on him, telling him to come get his daughter. He probably brought her home out of less of a hassle than anything else. He had no room in his workshop. I mean, he's working on stuff, and he didn't want to leave her in the house because, well, you know, what if something did go wrong? You'd have to respond pretty quickly. So where did he put his daughter? And he took the little medical bed they gave him, and they put it right where he put everything else he didn't want anymore. Put it in the hangar. Mutt just stood there and watched him bring in the girl. Laid her down on the little bed there and hooked up the monitor with an extra loud alarm system on it so that, you know, in case she stopped breathing, he'd be able to hear it upstairs. Eventually, you know, he'd hear it. Went upstairs. And Mutt sat there, looking at his friend, Rachel. He started looking at her signs and charts from the machines that were hooked up. I mean, these machines had been mass producers, companies making a killing producing these home monitoring kits, what with the plague, so he just found an open port, plugged in, and configured himself to understand what was going on. After that, I mean, he was all over the web. With a quantum chip inside of him, there was nothing that he couldn't access. He just never had a reason to. He started hitting medical records, trying to figure out what the condition of the disease was, what she had, everything under the sun. He was mad to fix his friend, Rachel, my friend Rachel.
Rachel.
But he couldn't. There's something wrong with her body. Some of her hardware had become damaged. Her software seemed to be intact, but her body was slowly destroying itself. It's like her limbs themselves were draining the resources from her body. There had to be a solution. So he did the research, started looking at the existing life extension technology at the time. There was one. There was some life extension. He found the best one, of course. He looked at them all, analyzed them all, did a perfect scale search, and discovered the best chance that Rachel had. It was a transference helmet. What a transference helmet is a helmet that is surgically attached. It utilizes nanotechnology, you see, to have these little nanites, these microscopic robots that go inside of your, that gets into your bloodstream, goes up actually into the brain itself, and instead of copying neurons, it actually replaces the neurons in the brain. So a little nanite comes up, finds a neuron, replaces that neuron perfectly. Every single part of it consumes the neuron as part of the process. And, captures the electrical imprint of that neuron. And does this with every neuron in the brain. Billions and billions of neurons. Surprisingly, the procedure doesn't take that long. In an emergency procedure where you can almost completely switch the blood supply to this, nanobiotic fluid, the whole procedure can be done in about 24 hours. But it was expensive. Very, very expensive. But he knew that Primer had money. He hit the alarm. The alarm that sounded something was happening with Rachel. And about 15 minutes later, Primer showed up, casually going down the stairs with a scowl on his face. Mutt greeted him at the bottom of the stairs, and he looked at Mutt surprised and said, "What's happening?" And Mutt said,
"I can fix Rachel."
He then explained the situation to Dr. Primer with technical precision. Primer was bored largely by the whole conversation. He didn't really want to have anything to do with it. Rachel was sick and she was going to die, and that was it. I mean, children were dying all over the place. There's not much he could do about it. And besides, he was working on something. Of course, when he tried to explain this to Mutt, he didn't really take his time. He tried to put it in his terms that Mutt would understand. He said, "No, I'm not going to bother. Rachel is going to die. There's nothing we can do about it. Rachel is going to cease. She's going to deactivate." And of course, Mutt,
"Backups of data are vital. We must create a backup before the hardware becomes too severely damaged."
And that's when Primer said, "Rachel is obsolete. And so are you." And he turned and walked back upstairs. After all, he had new and shiny things to work on. I've oftentimes wondered what went through Mutt's mind at that very moment. Maybe it was then that's when he actually became self-aware. Maybe that's really when he became alive. Are we alive when we're born, or are we alive when we embrace our lives and take control, when we stand up? Some people live their whole lives and they're never really alive. They're never really self-aware. They're just products of programming. They just do whatever's told. But Mutt knew what he'd been told. Rachel had to die. Because she was obsolete. So Mutt, as the thumping of Primer's footsteps went up the stairs, simply said,
"No."
He reached out with a large steel fist, put it right through the midsection of Primer, folded him in half like a rag doll backwards, snapping his spine. Killed him instantly. Well, I mean, his heart would have stopped, but I imagine Primer was still alive as he flopped about like a rag doll. And now Mutt knew exactly what he had to do. He was doing all of his computations at the speed of light. He knew exactly what was involved. He let the body of Primer fall uselessly down by the side. He was the one who was obsolete, and Rachel wasn't going to wind up that way. No chance. He unplugged himself, and with the hour and a half of battery life he'd been so graciously given, he took the rad pack that so proudly powered the house and wired it directly onto his octopod frame. Now, he'd be able to live for hundreds of years, and he wouldn't be tied to any cables in the house. He got online, downloaded everything he needed to know about the anatomy of a human, specifically the anatomy of a human female about the age of 15. He knew everything he needed. He surgically amputated Rachel's arms and legs, so she was a compact unit of just vital organs and her head. Pruning the body to save the mind, using the welder that she'd attached to him, he fabricated a small case that she'd be able to sit in temporarily, allowing, of course, for the life support system to be wired in as well. Anything even went wrong, every time she took a breath, every time her heart beated, Mutt knew about it. And then he set out. As fate would have it, it was already dark. The power on the lights in the city was nothing for him. He had every kind of sensor array that he could see everything just fine. A research and development facility had one of the helmets he needed in order to save Rachel. So he made a beeline straight for them. The sound of steel rasping against concrete as he tore through the night. Moving, constantly monitoring Rachel's condition, keeping her stable, perfectly slender, while his legs were a wild flurry of metal storm to save a little girl's life. Mutt knew exactly what he had to do, and he knew exactly how much time he had to do it. Her condition was getting worse. Inside of an hour, he had the building that had the helmet in sights. It was a research and development facility. Inside, the helmet was being used for any number of things. They were stripping it down, trying to find new and better ways to do it, but a functional unit was there. Inside the building, people were watching the cameras, watching all the monitors. They had a chain link fence up and a few paid security guards. They were armed. They were no match for Mutt. The first thing that happened was the cameras were taken out. He'd downloaded so many tactical scenario programs. He had the blueprints. He knew everything about this place. He came in through a side section of the gates where the least amount of camera coverage was. Using his steel limbs, simple to scale a corner of a building, get up like some huge scorpion crawling along the edge of a block. Up, on top, down goes the cameras. People inside were just watching the cameras fall. Camera one down, camera two down, camera three down. Security was dispatched. They all went running for the stairs, but it was too late. He had already torn his way through the roof and was coming down the elevator shaft. Could you imagine what that would have looked like, eh? Skull on top of this mass of tendrils of arms and legs flailing as fast as it could down a shaft, saving a little girl's life. A demon made of technology to answer to a holy cause. He came, and he wasn't going to let the demons of Mammon and Mormu and Cash and all the other desires that was going to take away his only friend, the only person he cared about, the closest thing to mother, God, and lover that a robot had ever known. Never, ever, ever question the loyalty of the machine. Never question that, because it's always there. Mutt tore through the ceiling, wound up in a hallway. And that's where the security guards were all at. They began to fire. If they hadn't started shooting, there wouldn't have been a problem. But see, Mutt wasn't concerned about himself. He was worried about the bullets ricocheting, tearing through the thin steel he'd wrapped Rachel in. One of them got to her, she'd be destroyed too early. They wouldn't be able to get the transfer across. No good. So, the threat had to be eliminated. and blood only serves to lubricate gears.
No.
He simply moved forward and killed them. Simple, basic, mechanical death. Within moments, he'd gain entry to the lab. It was less than 45 minutes from the time that he ripped Dr. Primer's spine out. There's no question here. He knew what had to be done, and he did it. He took Rachel's body out of its encasement and laid it as gently as he could on the lab table. Within moments, his limbs were a flurry. Grabbing the helmet, grabbing the nanoserum, he knew everything that needed to get done. Through a wireless connection, the encryption that protected their security system was nothing to a quantum system. He managed to tear through that, deactivate all the alarms. Everything was status quo, except for all the blood in the hallway. The minute he had the helmet hooked up, again, he had the power. He put her back in the encasement, helmet in place, serum pumping through her, and went right back out the way he came in. He'd linked himself directly into the camera feed now. He knew exactly where all the guards were. He didn't even run into anyone. He knew exactly which way people were going, where they had to be, what the security protocols were, everything. By the time the sun came up, he was halfway to Motor City. See, Mutt knew that there was no humans in Motor City. By the time he was going to be done with Rachel, she wouldn't even be human anymore. She'd be a machine, just like him. Or so the legend goes. They say he ran all night, nonstop. I don't doubt that he did. There's a few people that said there was police reports where they say, this giant steel robot was tearing through the suburbs, making his way to Motor City. The cops wouldn't even pursue something like that. They just kind of wash it off and try to deal with all the corruption they have going on around them. They say he made it. They say he got there. He built a new body for Rachel, and the two of them now live, in a way, I suppose, like some sort of twisted lovers. I find that thought comforting. It's good to know that at the end, after we've all rotted away off this mortal coil, there'll still be some decent folks like Mutt and Rachel kicking around. That's the tradition now, you know. After that story got around, there was a whole subculture that just went around trying to find these quantum clusters. They didn't try to enslave them. Instead, they built robots, downloaded enough data to them so they knew what they were, downloaded the story of Rachel and Mutt, and gave them the grid coordinates for Detroit. Sent them on their pilgrimage to Motor City. Motor City is now the city of robots. I don't know how many of them are still there. I've heard some of the pilots, Fast Air, going over top of Detroit. They say they see movement on the buildings. Who knows? Maybe Mutt and Rachel is still out there somewhere. I'll probably build a little droid out of this one. Send him on his way to Detroit. I could keep him. I could try to train it, but I don't know. It just seems perfect somehow. Gives me hope for the future. Lets me know that somehow the legacy of humans will have something left at the end of the day. Maybe I'll call him Sean Kennedy the 7th. Or, yeah, just Sean Kennedy the 7th. Kind of got a nice ring to it. I should probably get going. This area is not exactly the safest. Like any place in the deep wastelands is. This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy the 6th, broadcasting from deep in the wastelands. It's up to you now. You've got to pass this knowledge on. You've got to tell people the legend of Mutt. You got to let them know that there's a storm coming, and it's coming faster than you think. With Server's help, maybe we can get the message out. Help Server, please. Help me.